You know, one of the things that I think is so lovely and delightful about the Dhamma, about many different contemplative traditions have aspects of this, but that I really value in, you know, in this lineage is the way that the practice itself that's brought forward with such a pragmatic, straightforward approach, you know, that the practice itself, even without a lot of seeding the mind with philosophies or ideas, the practice naturally for some folks, but for many, opens the mind or the heart toward deeper questions. This is a practice of insight or seeing clearly, the practice of vipassana. Passana means seeing, and the V is an amplifier. So seeing intensely or more potently. And so it's a practice of inquiry. You know, mindfulness always contains in it an investigative quality, an understanding quality. And I think this is important to emphasize sometimes in relation to some modern renditions of the practice of mindfulness that emphasize its stress relieving and calming and focus training qualities, but de-emphasize its investigative or inquiry qualities. There can be a sense that the purpose of mindfulness is to think less, be less troubled, and be more in the moment, in a kind of non-reflective way, that is peaceful. And it can be peaceful momentarily. In a certain way, I think that's a description of concentration practice, of samadhi, more than it is a description of mindfulness. Mindfulness in this sense is a tool to attain a kind of gentle samadhi that's a bit of a break from cognitive excess. But mindfulness itself, as presented in the texts, and as we study it by deepening in the instructions over time, not just getting a very simple instruction, stay with the breath, come back when you've wandered, but to really work with the whole body, to work with the feeling body, to attend to the movement of energy, to watch the upwelling of difficulty, like bubbles arising in a river and bursting and dissolving, that the practice itself of vipassana is said to naturally give rise to insight, to give rise to the insight into impermanence, into the process nature of things, to give rise to the understanding that nothing is fixed or static. This is beautiful, I think, partly because practice opens us toward questions like the ones that that you're stirring into the pot here. You know, questions about the nature of what it is to be a body, to be conscious, to be awake. what things mean, which is really what emptiness is an inquiry around, is what do things mean? What's really true? And so the classic inquiries in the Dhamma are not speculative philosophical inquiries. You know, what exists after death? Do we really exist? Is it all illusion? Those kinds of questions were rejected by the Buddha as being not useful. Interesting sometimes, but not really useful. And he would refuse to answer them, including questions about whether he himself would exist after death or not. And so anytime we might take on a simplistic cognitive or intellectual idea, oh, I think I know what samsara is, I think I know what rebirth means, you know, or what emptiness means, or what liberation is, oh, it's the end of rebirth. What does that mean? What does that mean? Especially through layers of cultural translation, where you probably don't believe, whatever that means, in a kind of literal rebirth. You might. I don't even know if the Buddha did. He wouldn't say. But he used rebirth as a way to talk about us in the present having a relationship with the deep past, the entire history of the universe up till this point. And I think the question of rebirth, which is really the question of birth and death and how we think about those milestones in one's existence, is at the heart of the Dhamma, of the teachings. Because if we dismiss birth and death as simply bookends beyond which there are no words, as if there's an empty bookshelf or a bookshelf full of other people's stories, but they're not ours, and then there's a bookend, and then there's a bunch of stories that I call myself, and then there's a bookend, and after that, there's maybe more books in the library, but they're not me, so whatevs. I don't think it's helpful to think of birth and death that way, because it cuts us off from others. Even the idea that my birth somehow is the beginning of myself requires me to minimize somehow the strange mystery of procreation, of parenting, of what happens in a mother's body that creates another human or another animal. Today on the road coming back from Dropping River at school, I saw a mama fox and two little kits, and they were just about the size of a loaf of bread, little tiny like gray fuzz balls with their little fuzz sticking out all over the place. Blessings to the kits. May they be well. Something happens at birth where, you know, bodies, new bodies are created through the actions of other bodies. The whole of the Dhamma, in a certain way, can be thought of through the lens of what do we do with the mystery of sex and birth and death. So the desire for connection and intimacy that leads to sex, the sex that leads to birth, the birth that leads to suffering and joy and the whole mixture of beingness, and then the death that comes inevitably after that. So the Buddha traces the whole process in a certain way back to that desire. One way we might think about desire or craving, tanha, the second noble truth, craving being the cause of dukkha, is in relation to this existential or birth process. Often when we think about the first and second noble truths, you know, we go with the definition of the first noble truth that there's physical pain that's inevitable and psychological or mental suffering that is optional. I don't love the word optional at all. If it was optional, I would choose not to do it, but I do it all the time. So it must not be optional. It's conditioned. You know, it's what it is not inevitable, but at the moment it's unavoidable until liberation. So optional, I think, is a little bit, a little too casual for my taste for suffering. But if we actually hear the definition of dukkha in the First Noble Truth, it doesn't immediately go to the teaching of the two arrows. That's where that, like, you know, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. That comes from a teaching called the two arrows or the two darts, where the first dart or the first arrow is the pain simply of having a body. It's painful. It hurts sometimes a lot, you know. The second dart, so the first dart is physical pain, and the second dart is mental pain, mental emotional, right? So it doesn't have to be unsatisfying or distressing to have a body, but it will sometimes be painful. That's the teaching of the two darts. But the first noble truth doesn't go there. That's not actually how the first noble truth is described. The first noble truth says, this is the noble truth of dukkha. Dukkha that's often translated as suffering. I like dissatisfaction or distress. Let's just go with dukkha for now. This is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is dukkha. Aging is dukkha. Death is dukkha. Not getting what you want is dukkha. Getting what you didn't want is dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. In short, the five aggregates, when clung to, are dukkha. So it's really a list of painful things. And it starts with birth. Birth is painful. I trust the moms when they say, yep, that's true. But I was also a baby, and I think that I can say that there's truth in that. I know that things being feeling not quite right, not quite safe, not quite the way I want, it's just pervasive in this having a body thing. You know, not getting what you want is dukkha. Did you have any dukkha today? You know, did you not get what you wanted at any point today? You're like, oh, I want something. It's not happening, you know? Did you get something that you didn't want? Yesterday, I got a headache. I didn't want that. That was dukkha. And so the Buddha says, well, the cause of dukkha is craving. Tanha literally means thirst, second noble truth. Craving for existence. So craving for sensual pleasures, first of all. So three kinds of craving. Second noble truth, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, craving for non-existence. So there's a way that we can think about dukkha, which is, now we can think of as synonymous with being alive, essentially. There is dukkha, because You were born, you're aging, you're dying, you're getting what, not getting what you want, you're getting what you didn't want, all the things. That's the first noble truth is meant to be obvious. The noble truths aren't in order, you know. They're not in chronological order. First there was craving, then there was suffering, then there was practice, then there was freedom, right? The truths should go number two, then number one, then number four, then number three. But they don't go in that way because they're not a chronological sequence. They're an argument. And so they start with the only thing that's obvious, the thing that you know, the thing that you can't argue against. The premise of the whole thing is that it's painful. So the Buddha starts there and you're supposed to be like, yeah, so far so good, I'm with you. And then he gives you the kicker, number two, the cause is craving. And the first part of the craving is sensual pleasures. So lust for sensual pleasures gives rise to birth, right? The first element in tanha is craving for sensual pleasures, and the first element of dukkha is birth. So lust gives rise to birth in a fairly direct way. And so from the lens of sexuality and its connection to birth, we can really turn our mindfulness, our inquiry toward this most fundamental want that as animals we carry around, all in different ways, some more, some less, some seemingly not at all, but it's in there in the species system so deeply that here we are, all of us, again and again, for a very long time, filling the planet with bodies. And so the question of death and what we might call, you know, one's soul or the essence of one's being is completely inseparable from this desire gave rise to birth thing that started it off. And so from there you can see how in the Buddha's logic, then, desire gives rise to bodies, desire gives rise to suffering, desire gives rise to rebirth. And so you get the sequence, there's a different place that sequence is played out, is in the sequence known as dependent origination, where in the middle of that sequence, there's that really potent chunk that says, you know, when there's a body, there's the senses. When there's the senses make contact with the world. When the senses make contact with the world, they react. They react with liking, disliking, or neither. Kind of numbness, not noticing. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, vedana. Right? There's sense contact, and then there's feeling. And the feeling is this basic affect. I like it, I don't like it. And based on liking and disliking, wanting arises, thirst, tanha. That same second noble truth arises. Based on wanting, attachment or grasping, which is the action part, arises. Right? Grasping and action are two sort of phases of the process. There's the grasping, which is like the wanting, and then there's the attachment itself, the clinging. So based in sense contact, liking and disliking, based in liking and disliking, wanting things to be a certain way, wanting to get what we want, wanting to avoid what we don't want. Based in wanting, attachment, based in attachment, birth or becoming. Based in becoming, birth, and based in birth, old age, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. It kind of rolls off the tongue, you know. And then the whole process, you know. And so then, right, coming through the lens of you know, this most material interpretation of this as sexuality, sense contact gives rise to liking. Liking gives rise to wanting. Wanting gives rise to attachment or contact. contact gives rise to becoming, becoming gives rise to birth, jati, and there's babies. And so this intimate connection between wanting and living is established. Living implies dying. And there's really the assumption in the texts that dying is something that instinctually beings don't want. It's acknowledged that fear of dying is a thing. It's kind of what motivates the Buddha in the first place to seek. And so there's no way to undo past births. Therefore, acceptance, forgiveness, all the things. Understanding the past, insight into the past. Here we are already alive, which means we are already the product of desire, and we have not yet come to the end of desire. And so turning our attention, our lens, our inquiry toward death, then, in a Dharma sense, is the most important gesture, because it's the thing that marks our most fundamental suffering, which is that we've arrived in this field of painfulness. The fact that the field of painfulness has a lot of beauty and pleasure in it doesn't cancel out the painfulness. That's the humanistic argument. If you have enough of each one, you're just cool. The Buddha, from the lens of eternity, rejected that as satisfying. And actually said, no, actually, if you add it up, you don't want to go through the pain again and again and again and again, even though it's beautiful. I think the argument from the humanistic side that there's beauty in the world to be savored and there's painful things to be understood, I think that works actually pretty well if there's only one life, if there's a relatively limited span of those things going on. Because even the most pleasurable things in the world, the most beautiful, lovely things, you get tired of them. I've been privileged to have eaten some of the best food in the world. You know, I've eaten at marvelous, cheap Thai and sushi restaurants that were some of the best food in the world. And I've eaten at Chez Panisse, which I can essentially never afford to eat at. It was a gift once from a Dharma friend. It was lovely. And you know, like the pleasure of that kind of beauty, it's not infinite. You get tired of it. You don't need it. There's no entertainment in the world that will last forever in a way that satisfies you. Even partnership, and God bless partnership. It's good. It's solid, right? I've been married for 18 years. That's medium long in the scope of things, I think. It's great. I love being married. It's not great. It's just being married, you know? It changes. And the pleasures that we began it with have changed, right? All of y'all who have been in long partnerships, you know that, right? All of y'all who have attained any amount of age at all, which is everyone here, as far as I can tell, you know this, right? And so the Buddha is really saying, contend with this. Like, don't be in denial of this or deluded about this. Actually contend with it, and with the recognition that we are embedded in a flow of this desire, birth, death thing that goes on and on and on and on. And what's our relationship to that? If we're not just stuck in a kind of narcissistic, like, this life only and then I'm out, and you know, whatever for everybody else. But if we actually have an expansive consciousness around our participation in this desire and birthing, deathing thing, what might we do about that? I think the idea that there's a deep beauty in us that we might call soul is so compelling because it feels like it balances out the heaviness of dukkha. And I think it does in a way. I think perhaps, you know, the soulfulness of sentient beings, humans and animals and divine beings and spirits, beings who feel and think and move and are in relationship with each other. I think the soulfulness of beings is the thing that makes life bearable and beauty and beautiful. I think it's also probably what makes practice and liberation possible, because something is here that is very mysterious, that allows us to step back from being immersed in the desire, wanting, craving complex enough to see it for what it is, right? We call it in a very prosaic way, oh, that's mindfulness, or that's, you know, practice. But what if that actually is soul? That there's something that can see, that has the ability to not be unconscious. There's an ability to be conscious where we can share, we are sharing with each other. I'm saying, look, I've been taught these things. Here's what I think about this thing. And you have some questions, I have some questions. The fact that we can do this is a very soulful situation. The fact that we can appreciate so much is a very soulful situation. And so what do you do with your soulfulness? Soul isn't a thing that you have, it's a quality that you cultivate. And so with your soulfulness, I think you attend with intimacy to this life. I was so glad you said death, because while you all were coming up with questions, I was reading a Cambodian devotional song called Befriending Death. And so here's a couple lines from it. Lord death praises, and Lord time blesses all who follow the path to release. For our planet shall end in fire, far from this world, for our planet shall end in fire. Realms of pure form, blissful heavens, and all beings will burn to ash, their merit gone. Once their karma is exhausted, they'll be reborn in human form once more in samsara, the endless stream of birth and death, drowned by desire, like brutes, like beasts. Four Buddhas awoke, but you're still trapped, far from their light. Regret your fall, ponder things deeply. You're fortunate to meet the Dharma. So praise all Buddhas, wells of merit, springs of virtue. Lift their feet high above your head each night and day without a lapse. Make your mind bright as the sun's orb, suffused with light. When your life ends, your mind will soar, reaching the highest heavenly spheres. Study your mind. Learn to reflect on every state, the good, the bad, the calm, the clear, the sore, the sad, the final goal. One thought shatters into 1,500 unwholesome states. Marred by greed, you shun the good, the path of merit. The wise know their mind, and there abide a lotus in mud. Single in thought, their minds don't leak out the nine doors. They stay focused. Keep your heart as bright as the moon. Know your own breath. When inner winds are clear and at ease, the centered mind attains the goal. That's from Until Nirvana's Time, Buddhist Songs from Cambodia. It's translated by Trent Walker, a gorgeous book of new translations of Cambodian Dharma songs. I'll pause there, and we're just about at our time.